The topic for tonight is Foundations of Jewish Medical Ethics, which is a title I chose to challenge myself, since I'm actually supposed to be teaching a course on that this year, and I didn't know very much about it. So I figured that probably before teaching the course, I should know something about the foundations of what I'm talking about. But I need to qualify anything I say tonight with an opening disclaimer, which is that this is not my area of expertise. That gives me a little bit of freedom. I don't have to say the same thing everyone else does. And if I say things that are ridiculous, you'll just blame it on my not yet being fully immersed in the field, and possibly I'll say things that are more challenging than people usually in the field are. Let's begin. When we talk about foundations of Jewish medical ethics, so we have to figure out, what do we mean when we talk about Jewish ethics in general? Right? What is a Jewish ethic? And is there a difference between a Jewish ethic and Jewish law? Right? Is saying foundation of Jewish medical ethics the same thing as saying fundamental principles of medical halakha? Now, one approach one can take is to say yes. But obviously, every issue in Jewish life eventually comes down to a question of halakha. And the way Rav Lichtenstein famously framed it is, it, do we or do we not believe that there is an ethic in defense of halakha? Right? That would be one perspective. A second perspective, and without attributing to Rav Lichtenstein one answer or another on the side of the question, because he ends the article famously by saying it depends how you define the term. Right? Because ethics are independent of halakha in one sense, and in another sense, once you decide that something is ethical, it becomes mandatory, and things that are mandatory become part of halakha. We could, but that's one possible. One possible perspective is to say that there should not be room for any concept of the ethical outside of halakha. A second way of framing it is a wonderful epigram of Rabbi Norman Lamb, Shlita, who says that halakha is minimal Judaism. Right? Meaning observing halakha means that you've done the least that a Jew can do to live up to their obligations. But if it's a Jew who lives only up to halakha, right, is not coming anywhere near living a total religious life. And in that perspective, there's a lot of room for an ethic outside of halakha. Right? So it's what tells you to do in every area where we don't tell you specifically what to do. Okay, so that's one issue one has to begin to think about, right? Are we just asking for principles of law? Or are we asking for principles that enable us to regulate our behavior even when there is no specific law? Okay, second question is, what kind of topic should we address? So I'll give you as a mashal. Suppose I were giving a lecture on foundations of Jewish political ethics. Right? Now, a lecture of foundations of Jewish political ethics, I would address exactly two topics. One is, when is it legal to start a war? And the other is, when is it legal to stop a war? Right? When are you allowed to make war, and when are you allowed to make peace? I would not address, in any way, the question of what it means to organize a state. Whether it's at war or at peace, whether leaders should be chosen democratically or oligarchically, or on the basis of merit, or on the basis of scholarship, or on the basis of family, I would not address the rights of minorities or majorities. I wouldn't address the equitable distribution of goods in a society. I wouldn't address any of that. All I would talk about is war and how to start it, and peace, right, and peace and when to bring it. From what I can tell, and again, not as an expert in the field, much discussion of Jewish medical ethics involves discussion of when does life start and when does life end. And what happens in between, we seem to have very little to say about. And our discussions of how one begins life and how one ends it, right, are built entirely on those questions. And Emil Falkenhayn had this famous claim that the 614th commandment of the Torah is to survive, and that eventually its inadequacy was demonstrated when people pointed out there has to be a good reason to survive. Right? Survival has to have a purpose beyond itself. By the same token, even if we think a central issue in medical ethics is when life begins, and how long life lasts, that question is only important because we have a conception of life being important. Right? In order to address, even to address those issues, right, about the, right, how to deal with difficult questions associated with the initiation and termination of life, we have to have some conception of what the purpose of human life is. In that sense, it really is impossible to talk about Jewish medical ethics without talking about them as a subcategory of Jewish ethics. Now that, of course, could be an excuse for me to avoid the topic entirely and say, now that I've made Jewish medical ethics as part of the broad question of Jewish ethics, now I can talk about what I like to talk about generally in terms of ethics and the like. And some people have heard a lot of my shiur and may, in fact, find similarities between what I have to say on this topic and certain other topics. But I want to assure you that even though we'll start that way, I do intend right, to move back to the specific topic of medical ethics, but I want to argue that really medical ethics has to be treated as a subcategory of ethics in general, and that in order to accomplish this, right, one has to first concede or assert right, that there is room for a topic called Jewish medical ethics. Okay, so now I'm going to begin this year with something that's probably really unfair. I'm going to begin by quoting an obsolete website. Right, it's a website for, it once was the organization, the website of the Falk Schlesinger Institute for Medical Halakha, Medical Halakhic Research, which is, I think, legitimately, probably the premier site of Jewish medical halakha. In the world, it runs a superb summer program. It puts out two excellent journals, Asia and Jewish Medical Ethics. And so I want to say at the outset, this is not what their website currently says. But what their website used to say is nonetheless very instructive, right, for thinking about conceptions of Jewish medical ethics. Okay, so if you take a look at the beginning of your packet, right, so this is source number one. Okay, they begin by saying that medical ethics has several primary goals, including increasing the sensitivity and awareness of medical practitioners and researchers to the moral problems associated with treatment and research, imparting basic philosophical and legal knowledge relating to moral problems, advancing national analysis and debate regarding moral medical matters, encouraging the combination of technical medical knowledge with human sensitivity, morality, and justice, and improving the moral conduct of medical practitioners, and perhaps improving their moral character. Okay, so far, sounds good. All right, then they say, however, noble though these goals be, and although we're pretty much in favor of all these noble goals, the pluralistic and multidisciplinary nature of medical ethics has made a normative consensus in many areas of medical practice impossible. In contrast, Jewish medical ethics is based on halakhic principles which generally provide clearer and more practical answers to the difficult ethical conflict in medical practice. Jewish medical ethics, in the sense of applying normative Jewish law and philosophy to practical medical issues, is characterized and distinguished from general medical ethics in at least three spheres. Okay. Yes, go. Sure. I imagine they probably meant Eretz Yisrael when they wrote this. Right, for them. But they're talking about medical ethics generally, right, all over the world. Right, that's the purpose, right? Right, so the first claim is that halakhic, right, the purpose of Jewish medical ethics and the advantage of Jewish medical ethics is that we give clearer answers to practical questions than they do. And now, first of all, we could raise the whole issue about whether it is useful to talk about the uniqueness of Judaism because we're better, as opposed to simply what we do. Right? I tend not to be in the mode of saying that, right, that we have to justify ourselves because we're different. Right? We are what we are, and if it happened that the whole world came to agree with us, I wouldn't be so upset. Right? That's issue number one. Secondly, right, this would seem to mean that Jewish medical ethics fail if we fail to achieve the consensus. Right, that the purpose of doing what we do Jewishly is so that we can know for certain what to do, and that will save us from the morass of secular ethics, right, in which people can make up their mind. That seems to me highly questionable, as you can read articles in their own medical journal, right, in which they say, unfortunately, no normative consensus has been reached in halakha in regard to most issues of major medical practice. Most famously, right, Rabbi Bleich and Rabbi Tendler are still debating brain death, and will still be debating brain death in Yerushalayim 20 years from now, without changing their opinions. Right, in almost every issue, right, you can find a range of halachic opinions that roughly parallel the range of secular ethical opinions. And where a consensus develops, I would go out on a limb and say it's mostly because practice develops to the point where certain halachic positions become obsolete. Right, because people no longer bother asking questions that are not relevant to anyone's practice. So I'm not at all sure that I want to argue that Jewish medical ethics are different because halakha is not pluralistic in that sense. Okay, then we have a claim. Right, moving to the next stage. Right, we have a claim that current medical ethics has shifted the locus of decision making from the physician to the patient, thus accepting the primacy of autonomy in the patient-physician relationship. The principle of autonomy has become absolute, taking precedence over all other values, such as life and beneficence. This minimalistic view of ethics replaces the concern we should show for each other, neglects the model of beneficence, and most importantly, this supremacy of autonomy leads to the development of individual moral obligations, while societal regard for the common good is discarded. In contrast, Judaism subscribes to a higher order of moral conduct, which mandates the behavior of the individual as well as of society. Okay, I got a little bit lost here, I have to say, where it seems that secular ethics relates entirely to the individual, whereas Judaism mandates behavior of the individual as well as of society. I'm not entirely sure that I can parse that. But even leaving that aside, so here, I think there's a marvelous article, a very, very important article by Rabbi Tendler, written years ago, which says the following. Rabbi Tendler asks the question, why is it ever okay for a society to build museums? All funds in a society should be, right, if we really believe halakhically that pikuach nefesh dochet hakol, right, that saving lives overwhelms everything, so then it should not be permitted for any society to spend its money on anything other than hospitals and medical research. That museums, parks, all that kind of stuff, right, all that kind of stuff is out. As we have to, right, we have to focus all our resources on preserving life and making life worth living, right, is not a value that has the right to stand up to the preservation of life. Bishop Attendler's response is that the halakha has to be decided differently on a communal level than an individual level. Right, the considerations which would not be allowed in specific detail cases have to become relevant, right, when one is dealing with society as a whole. And therefore I'm not entirely sure that the claim that halakha as such is the vehicle by which one is entitled to think about the interests of society is necessarily correct. But we'll get back to that as we go on. We will get back to this question of whether the claim is a secular ethics, and again, that's a straw man. I don't need to defend secular ethics. It talks only about autonomy, right? And our contribution is that we limit autonomy. How far do we limit autonomy? Right? To what degree, right? If secular ethics transfers the locus of decision making from the physician to the patient, right? Where do we think the decision making should be? Entirely in the physician? Okay. Then we get to another sentence which I think is really critical, where they say, being pluralistic, general ethics does not generally aspire to absolute normative decisions. Jewish medical ethics, on the other hand, is essentially based on a halakhic approach to medical problems. Its solutions are thus as binding as halakhic decisions in any other field, such as kashrut, shabbat, or theft. Okay, so here, we get into a very important question about what the aspiration of the halakhic society should be. Right, one vision is that the aspiration of a halakhic society is for us to have rules which govern every aspect of our behavior, and ideally, individuals would never have to make decisions. Firstly, we should have books, which can tell individuals as much as possible what to do in every case, right, because most of the time one should not even need to resort to a rabbi. Right, one should be able to look up a handy book, put out by, say, Masora Publications, right, which produces many handy books of this sort, and I tend to think that they do a good job on the whole. We are, unfortunately, they have not yet produced a sufficiently comprehensive work, let's say, whereas for those of us who read Hebrew, there is now a 2-volume Erev Tavshil and Tilchata, which gives you a list of every conceivable food so that you know whether you can use it as one of the two cooked foods for Erev Tavshil on Yom Tov, but that book has not been translated into English yet. Right, so in circumstances in which you perhaps are presented with a new type of food, when you're not sure which you have for some reason have this deep desire to use as your Erev Tavshil, so if you don't read Hebrew, you will be compelled to call your rabbi, who happily will have the Hebrew book, and thereby be able to give you the answer as to whether you can use this food for that purpose. Right, but the vision, it's the vision of halachic life is one which has no uncertainty. Right, and one which has no, which does not value the capacity to make decisions in any way other than by finding out what the right answer is. The right answer presumably being known and knowable, and the only issue is whether you have access to the person who can tell you what the known and knowable answer is. Right, that's one vision of what a halachic lifestyle is. The second vision, from a book that I am extremely fond of, is Rabbi Walter Wurzburger's Zichrono Livracha's work, The Ethics of Responsibility, which Rabbi Wurzburger argues that actually most of the really important decisions in life cannot be made on the basis of rules that somebody else tells you, and certainly cannot be made by abdicating your decision-making to somebody else. The way I like to frame Rabbi Wurzburger's argument, I think it's fair the way he said it. He wrote this in the late 60s, in the original article that this was built up, was in the late 60s, in which he said there were two critiques of halakha. One was that it turned people into moral automatons, who never got to make decisions and therefore never developed their virtue, right? Never became better human beings. And the second was halakha didn't tell people whether or not to support the war in Vietnam. So Rabbi Wurzburger was the first one to point out that these two critiques contradicted each other. How can we say that halakha turns you into a moral automaton if it doesn't tell you whether to support the war in Vietnam? Which I think it was fair to say that for an American in the late 60s, early 70s, was one of the moral issues one had to confront. We could argue whether halakha told you or not to support the civil rights movement. I would hope it did. And therefore, Rabbi Wurzburger argues that the purpose of halakha is to train you in a process of serious decision-making, which would enable you to make better decisions when the decisions that went beyond, when the decisions that went beyond rules came up. Okay, that's a very different vision. And so then the question we could ask is the purpose of Jewish medical ethics to remove all areas of uncertainty and eventually to reach a normative consensus so that patients or families confronted by difficult moral situations can look the answer up with complete confidence that there is a book in which the answer can be found, or can call any rabbi, knowing that every rabbi will give them the same answer, and that answer will be exactly what God wants. Right, is that the purpose of halakha, or is the purpose of Jewish medical ethics to create a framework in which people confronted by their particular medical decisions, challenging moral medical decisions, can make serious decisions, and part of that decision making is when to realize that they either so involved or so out of their depth that they need to ask a shayla. The original version of this website set out, I think, very clearly that the purpose of Jewish medical ethics really is limited to halakha, and when things go beyond halakha, it's because we failed. We don't have an adequate perception of God's will, but if we did, we would be able to tell you what to do in every case. Okay. So, as part of this, they say that whereas general ethics is based on philosophic analysis, Jewish medical ethics is based on halachic analysis. The difference is that general ethics derive from human thought and variable opinions, whereas Jewish ethics is based on halakha and Jewish thought, which are of divine origin and were interpreted and applied by the Talmudic sages and subsequent authorities in the direct line of tradition, and therefore presumably are not subject to variable opinion. Okay, right, and deciding medical ethics is not different in any way or kind than deciding Hilchot Nida, and deciding right for and or deciding Kashrut. Right, last paragraph. Rather, it is essential to be guided, right, it is therefore impossible to solve moral problems in medical practice on the basis of the patient's or the physician's proclivities or personal feelings. Rather, it is essential to be guided by an authoritative rabbi whose decisions are reached on the basis of relevant halachic considerations. Of course, right, familiarity with halachic sources is in itself insufficient for halachic decisions. One must have a comprehensive grasp of all the relevant facts and their halachic sources, which, combined with a profound understanding of relevant data, which apparently is distinct from facts and sources, can lead to the correct solution, to the correct solution of moral problems. Okay. Right? So that, it seems to me that this, there are certain types of texts which I think are extraordinarily useful because they provide the best or clearest presentation of the wrong position. Alright, so I want to suggest that this text presents a really, really clear presentation of what I would argue is the wrong position. That the purpose of Jewish medical ethics should not be to reduce everything to law, should not be to eliminate the moral responsibility of everyone involved in the situation to make decisions. That we should not presume that the inability to reach consensus is a product of is evidence of failure. That the goal of halacha is always to reach a single opinion. And finally, it's not clear to me that the contribution of halacha should be the limitation on autonomy. And here two points need to be made. One is a general fallacy that occurs in many, many fields when one compares halakha to other areas. And the second is a point that I will make entirely on my own responsibility, and you can decide if you want to buy it or not. The first point is that people often distinguish between halakha and other fields by saying, well, look, halakha mandates the individual's behavior, whereas secular law does not. Right? That's the category error. Right? Law, on the whole, does not regulate unenforceable behavior. Right? Law regulates behavior that we wish to impose on people. It's generally, well, not entirely, there are cases where law is made only as a moral statement, but on the whole, right, secular law is designed to tell you, right, what it is that the state will impose on you. Religious systems, such as halakha, are designed to tell you what you ought to do. Now, this fallacy is bad enough in that direction, but it often has what I think is an even worse corollary, which is the presumption that because halakha tells you to do or not do something, that means that halakha desires to enforce it on you. And so the ideal halakhic state is one in which every detail of halakha is enforced by people wandering around with whips, right? And ideally, right, we'd be very happy with the halakhic thought police. I don't know if some of you, right, there was an, what was it called, not Total Recall, I forget, there was one, a film made up, an old Philip K. Dick novel about precognitive police forces that can tell if you're about to commit a, pardon? Minority Report, right, that can tell if you're about to commit murder, and then they rush in and they get you before you do it, right, but that's really our goal. Is to create a society in which we can prevent all sin, and we enforce any deviation from the norm. It's not entirely right. I think that is a mistake occasioned by the absence of coercive power in halakha, right? Because we can't actually enforce anything, therefore we presume that we really would enforce everything. That's not entirely clear to me that should be our goal. A second point I think there are really good warrants for. A second point, which I admit I make entirely my own recognizance, and you can, reject it just on that basis if you wish, is The question of whether we are required to presume that the halachic answer is definitionally superior to any other answer that can be posed to the same issue. What the reason that, among other issues, that in most issues of medical halakha there is a wide divergence of opinion is that there isn't actually a clear masoret. We don't have a tradition going directly back to Sinai to tell us about whether brain death is death or not. What we have are cases and values and analogies which our poskim do the best they can to determine the will of God based on those precedents. But it's possible that they make mistakes. Either Reb Leif or Reb Sandler is making a mistake. Right? And depending on in a society constructed according to Reb Leif's rules, people would die. If Reb Sandler is right, people would die because they don't have organ transplants. Because we have not harvested patients. We have not harvested organs from patients who are in fact dead. But our halachic decision that sapek pikuach nefesh of the patient or the sapek ratzifa of the patient overrides the sapek pikuach nefesh of the recipients, If Rabbi Bleis is wrong and Rabbi Tendler is right, so a lot of people are dying in that decision, and that's probably not a morally ideal situation, and we would have to say that the Harvard criteria, if in fact that's right, Rabbi Tendler is right, the secular Harvard criteria did better than halacha on the narrow moral issue. If, on the other hand, Rabbi Bleis is right, but let's say as is in fact the case, most of the halachic community follows Rabbi Tendler, the RCA issues a medical care proxy that follows Rabbi Tendler, that means that we are complicit in lots of murders. Because we are removing people from respirators, even though they are still halachically alive. Now, one of those two positions is right. Now, we don't know which of those two positions is right. We don't have a guarantee that because one person asked Rabbi Tendler and the next person asked Rabbi Bleis, that means they got the right answer to the question. What we have is a guarantee that Jews living a serious halachic life are entitled to be someh on decisions that are made seriously by poskim. And as Jews, we have a chiyuv to live in accordance with our system, and we ask our questions in good conscience, and we trust that on the whole, that our sincere efforts to determine God's will with integrity enable us to live a pretty good life. But I don't know that means that we have to say that we're right and they're wrong. I'm a student of Rabbi Bleis. On the brain death issue, I tend to be much more conservative than most other poskim, and to be choshesh for Rabbi Bleis' position. But I understand that I might be right or I might be wrong. If the Harvard criteria are genuinely right, then my tzach would be one which causes people to die unnecessarily. For that reason, I tend to avoid poskening such issues, because I know that on this case I follow a minority position, and it's not clear to me that other people's lives should be subject to my unwillingness to poskin against a rebbe on an issue of such severity. And I recall to you last time I spoke of Rabbi Willig's stock on TapeX, where he sent people to ask Rabbi Waldenberg because he wasn't willing to poskin against Rav Moshe. I don't know. But I don't think that discussions of Jewish medical ethics, which is an area where we have to admit that we are being creative, that we're still trying to figure out what it is the real meaning of the Masoret is, that we have to start our discussion on the presumption that whatever answer we reach halakhically is necessarily the right answer. One could coin a term, it might be halakhic humility. Your time, when it's appropriate even within our system, to consider the possibility that we're wrong. Okay, after all that. But we're almost at actual medicine. So I want to present a theological model for how Judaism views medicine. And I'm going to do a very dangerous thing, which is quoting the Rav. I tend to be very leery about quoting the Rav with authority, although I'll probably do it again this Shabbos. At least I think I'm very leery about quoting the Rav. Probably I quote him as much as anybody else does. But I think that this is a passage that is in serious accord with a lot of with the general theme in this philosophy, and I want to offer it as a perspective on how we should approach medicine that I think is not usually taken. Right, this is from Lonely Man of Faith. Now, Lonely Man of Faith, you'll recall, is structured as a analysis of the two types of human nature presented in in the opening chapters of Bereshit, Adam 1 and Adam 2. Right, so this is part of this characterization of Adam 1. Right, so what is Adam the first out to achieve? Adam the first wants to be human, to discover the entity which is bound up with his humanity. How does Adam find himself? He works with a simple equation introduced by the psalmist to proclaim the singularity and unique station of man in nature, for thou hast made him a little lower than the angels and has crowned him with glory and honor. And up till now, the Rav is very happy with the standard translation, but then he tells you honor? Not really right. Dignity. Right? That introduces that word, which becomes so central to what he's saying here. Right? To be human means to live with dignity. What is dignity and how can it be realized? And you're welcome to go back to the originals to find the stuff I left out. The answer we find again in the words of the psalmist, who addressed himself to this obvious question and turned man not only an honorable, but a glorious being, spelling out the essence of glory in unmistakable terms, thou hast made him to have dominion over the works of thy hands, thou hast put all things under his feet. In other words, dignity was equated by the psalmist with man's capability of dominating his environment and exercising control over it. The brute's existence is undignified because helpless. There is no dignity without responsibility, and one cannot assume responsibility as long as he is not capable of living up to its commitments. And now we get to medicine. Man of old, who could not fight disease and succumbed in multitudes to yellow fever or any other plague with degrading helplessness, could not lay claim to dignity. Only man who builds hospitals, discovers their therapeutic techniques, and saves lives is blessed with dignity. Okay. Right, so what we were looking for from the outset is a theory of what it means, right, what the purpose of human life is, that would enable us to approach difficult questions such as when does life begin and when does life end, and how do we handle them. Okay, what I want to suggest is that Rabbi Soloveitchik here offers, right, basically a one-word summary, right, as to at least a significant part of human existence. Human existence is founded on dignity. Dignity means the capacity to control one's environment. And medicine, is really the epitome of human dignity, because medicine enables us to control whether we live or die. Right? The ultimate in dignity is not to be able to continue living. Right? Medicine enables us to continue living. Now, qualifier, this is only a portrayal of Adam 1. Right, there's Adam 2, which is an entirely different person who submits to God, who understands his dependence on God. But within the world of Adam 1, the doctor, is the character of Adam 1. Right, so the goal of life is dignity. The goal of advances in medicine is that they increase dignity. So, now that might seem to be an obvious opening for a critique of much of what we do now in end of life medical issues, right? Because if we really see life's purpose as being dignity, right? So then all issues, right? So then death of dignity becomes the primary value, as opposed to just the preservation of life without dignity. So I want to suggest that there are two breaks that need to be put on this. One again is the distinction between Adam 1 and Adam 2. Right, and saying that there is an aspect of the human personality which is rooted entirely in dignity doesn't mean there isn't another aspect of humanity, right, which sees yourself, which the whole goal is not to see yourself as sovereign over your own body and life. But the second issue, which I think is really important for thinking about this issue, is the distinction between the dignity of the species and the dignity of the individual. Rabbi Soloveitchik writes about here is the dignity of the species, right? By our capacity to keep individual human beings alive, we demonstrate as humanity our capacity to dominate nature, even if it may be that in a particular case, right, that the dignity of the species is purchased as the cost of the dignity of the, individual. I mean, it seems to me that that is, right, it's a calculation that would be very valuable for thinking about these issues, realizing that, right, keeping someone alive is a triumph, as, right, a triumph on the whole, but, right, that triumph can come at a cost. Not every life, right, not every preservation of life is adds to the dignity of the individual, but every medical advance adds to the dignity of humanity. Okay. That's one notion I want to introduce, right, is that the possibility of using dignity, explosive, but I think, you know, it can't be avoided halakhic term, it's what abriot, right? It's a dangerous term we don't like using in halakhic discourse as such, because it's so powerful. But at the same time, it is a threat, the Gemara calls it, right? You know, something very guttle kod habriot. Right? And it does formally push aside all rabbinic and a significant percentage of biblical commandments. And it seems to me that the Rav at least offers us an opportunity to introduce it into the discussion. I want to make a broader point, though, out of it, which is that, again, we shouldn't, right, as opposed to saying immediately, if we focus on dignity, so the immediate jump is, well, how do we deal with end-of-life issues where we have to choose between prolonging an apparently undignified life or not? Right, and we could reformulate that as a question, right? I think one can argue generally that death itself is an indignity. Right, and we have to figure out what indignity could be worse than death. We could do that. But the real issue is, right, which I think it would be tremendously useful if Halakhis began introducing this in the conversation, is should our effort be focused on how we deal with end-of-life issues, and should our resources be invested in prolonging life at the end? Or does this create an imperative to deal with issues such as the crisis in nursing? Right, which has contributed tremendously, right? Having empathetic, competent nurses, right, is probably the way I would suggest, right? This, you know, personal experience of grandparents, right, probably makes the largest difference in the dignity of patients in hospitals, right? And it seems to me that this offers room for saying that one thing we can contribute to the conversation is saying that we see the preservation of dignity in hospitals not just about whether robes should be open at the back or not. But the entire process of preserving the dignity of patients in hospitals should be a central concern, and not just making proper decisions as to when to pull the plug. Yes. Yeah, so I've avoided talking about specific halakhot. What I would say is, but since you give me an opening, I'm going to take 1 minute, which is that everyone takes the distinctions that are made halakhically, and let's presume them for the moment. I often quote that Rabbi Saul Berman gave a marvelous shiur at the Yeshiva of Brookline about 9 years ago, in which, to my mind, but I can't remember the shiur specifically, he just really blew up all the standard distinctions that we make between when yes and when no. But even granting that, so we all say, you cannot remove natural means of preserving life, such as food, right, but you can remove artificial means, and that teaches us the primacy of life. No? It teaches us the primacy of murder. Right? But it doesn't teach us the primacy of life, because if it taught us the primacy of life, then we wouldn't be allowed to remove medicine either. Right? It tells us that there's a balance. Right? And in cases where you would violate the issue of Ritzitha, so the Aveira of Ritzitha overrides, right, it overrides Budabriot. Whereas whatever the peril of the failure to preserve, to fulfill the nominal dam reyecha does not. So I think even taking the standard distinction, right, it's been misapplied as a statement of principle as opposed to dealing with a narrow fact. Right? But again, it's not my expertise. I don't want to go too far in there. And I need to call Rabbi Berman and get that full shear again, because I thought it was just a marvelous shear. Okay. What I want to do next is point out that there is one book which, it seems to me, without in any way saying that the existence of the numerous compilations of medical halakha that we have is not a tremendously valuable thing, produced by tremendous Talmidei Chachamim. Most books that we have are precisely about determining what to do in every specific case. I found last month the book that is entirely different, and it seems to me to open the capacity for a Jewish medical ethics along the lines that I suggested initially. It's a book called Duty and Healing by the late Dr. Benjamin Friedman, who was an Orthodox physician in Canada. He also had a PhD in philosophy and was a consulting ethicist at various Canadian hospitals. So apparently published his first as a 500-page book on the web, and then posthumously they came out with a 200-page hardcover edition and regrettably then removed the 500-page edition from the web. So this is a book called Duty and Healing by Benjamin Friedman, and I have to, you know, every once in a while you find a book that just makes you happy. So this book sort of made me happy for 3 weeks when I found it in June, because it was just such a great thing to find somebody who was willing to approach the issues that way. So I'm going to read three brief excerpts from his book and talk about what they tell us. Okay, so he begins by claiming that the centerpiece of modern medical ethics is the doctrine of informed consent. And patients have a right to decide on their own treatment, right? That the job of the physician, right, except in extremis, so the patient is incompetent, right, the job of the physician is to provide the patient with enough information to make an intelligent decision about their own treatment. Whereas, right, as witnessed in the initial quote, the general halakhic presumption is that the patient's obligation is to defer to the physician, right, and the patient is obligated to seek what the medical community normatively regards as the best form of treatment. Right, so he says, right, the absence of a rabbinic doctrine of informed consent is predicated upon the view that, in general, the patient's illness is diagnosed with certainty, and medical knowledge dictates that illness be treated in a single manner. This view, which fails to take seriously both medical uncertainty and medical controversy, is so obviously false, so obviously contrary to what every medical student is taught, that one wonders how it became so ingrained in rabbinic thought. And he has suggestions historically as to why it is that rabbis developed this idea that doctors are certain and doctors are right. All right, sort of the irony is, right, that halacha constructs the position of medicine, which is like that medical ethics, right, webpage vision of halacha. Right, there's one answer, everyone knows what that answer is, and the whole purpose of calling in doctors is to make sure you find the right answer to the problem, right, and that will, right, and that will work perfectly. Whereas, in fact, he suggests that if you have a conception of medicine, a real understanding of how medicine is practiced, particularly in the kind of cases which pose difficult ethical questions, right, discover that diagnosis is questionable, right, there always are minority opinions and majority opinions, and it's not all clear that deferring to doctors is the only reasonable approach. Right, and second quote he gives you, right, consider the following analogy. It may be argued on the basis of Jewish sources that a person has self-regarding duties of financial as well as physical well-being. Would it be reasonable to infer from these premises that a person is under a religious obligation to seek out financial counselors and to obey their advice blindly, unthinkingly, without asking them the reasons? Right? Would we say that, right, if that's really the case, right, you're not here, there's a prohibition of saltashkis, right, you can't waste your money. So maybe we should say that all Jews are required to call in professional economists and allocate all our resources according to that. I think we would understand that in that case, first of all, it's not fair, right? Why should you be bound by the mistakes that the majority of the field makes if you really think they're making a mistake? Right? Intelligent people are entitled to make up their own minds. Secondly, it's just undignified to say that all your decisions about how you allocate your resources should be made by somebody else. Right? So I think his argument for adoption of informed consent, right, the halakha should recognize this as a value, patients making their own decisions, right, is very much the concretization of Rav Soloveitchik's argument for the primacy of dignity. Right, that having the capacity to determine your own treatment, right, again, right, what one can stigmatize as autonomy, one can glorify as dignity. Right, that having the capacity to make your own decisions is an important part of being human. And to say that once you get sick, you no longer have any authority, all you can do is listen, right, seems to me to be taking away a good part of why it's worth living, and the religious purpose of being human. Okay, another book. I should say that one of the reasons that this book made me so happy is that for years and years people have told me that the difference between halakha and everything else, and American particularly, is that America is about rights and we're about duties. And yet I could not find a single case in which somebody gave me a sustainable nafkamina, a practical difference between the two. right? Let alone anybody who could explain, right? What, right? Why there was a difference between my having a right and somebody else having a duty to respect my right? Right? All rights impose duties, right? Because if you have a right, then I have a duty to respect it. Right? And all duties generate rights, probably. Not as obvious. This book actually consistently uses that distinction in a way which is meaningful. Right? So it's like finding a Brisker book that uses Gavra and Tefsa, right? In a way that's meaningful. It's a cause for celebration in its own, right? In its own terms. Okay. So, right, so one of the arguments he makes, right, a very powerful argument, he says, is that if you have a regime based on rights, so then you're automatically placing people in conflict with each other. Right? Each is right. We're trying to determine whose rights take precedence. Whereas if you're basing things on duty, then we all have the same interests. We all want to know what we need to do. Right? And so the value, right? So the value of halakha is that it recognizes everybody's stake in the decision. Right? In a rights model, ultimately determine who gets to make the decision, and everyone else becomes irrelevant. In a duty model, we understand that all of us have chiyuvim. And we have to figure out, how we can together fulfill our chiyuv. The doctor has the chiyuv to heal, I have the chiyuv to take care of my body, the family has the chiyuv to respect the parents, right? All of us can get together and try and figure out what is it that we together need to do. But one should not presume, right, that the physician, because he has an obligation to heal, therefore has a right to impose his healing on me. Right? Each of them, right? If there was a right, maybe my right to my body overrides the physician's right to heal. But if we both have duties, then we can work together and understand that we each have a stake in making the right decision. Okay. Right, you can read the quote about Justice Silberg there on your own later, which is a fascinating quote, but which we don't have time to do it tonight. Okay. So with all that as background, let's move into actual medicine. We're going to go through it fairly rapidly. Right, so what I gave you in source number 6 is the presentation of the tour of Yaakov ben Asher, right, his medieval code of basically his presentation of medical halakha and ethics. There isn't much controversy about this, interestingly enough. If you study all the sources, they pretty much you have a Talmudic statement which says from the verse Rapo Yirape, right, that physicians have either permission or authority to heal. Then the Ramban says that's the case, even though, right, so that they shouldn't have to think, why is this worth it to me? Maybe I'll kill somebody accidentally. And then pretty much everybody else quotes the same thing from then on. But it's an interesting text. I want to point out certain details in it. Okay, so the first thing, right, the first part of the tour deals with the question of permission or authority to heal. And I think actually authority is a better translation, because the point of it is that authority to heal exempts you, at least if you're licensed, from liability for damages. And the point is that we understand that physicians make mistakes, and therefore we need to put in right some kind of spiritual immunity, let alone physical immunity, right, financial immunity for mistakes. Obviously that imposes an obligation on physicians to be extremely careful. And there's a whole discussion about whether physicians have duties to specific patients or not. Which it turns out that we see the relationship between physicians and patients as personal, to the point where a doctor does not have the right to refuse himself on the grounds that another doctor is available, because maybe your connection to this patient will lead to healing, whereas another patient won't, right? The Gemara's framing of this is, you don't merit being healed from every person, maybe you're the doctor whom they merit being healed from. Right? That sets up a relational model of doctor-patient relationships, which I think is useful. Okay, right? Secondly, there's something which becomes very important, is the conception of whether physicians should see themselves as actually accomplishing something, or simply as the agent of God's will. Right, and this seems to me is a very important tension. There are, if you look at most of the doctor's prayers that exist in Jewish tradition, they emphasize over and over again that the doctor doesn't really heal, God heals. Right, and that is a strand of the tradition which argues that medicine, at best, is bidiyavad. It's something we resort to in the absence of prayer. And really, even when we resort to it in the absence of prayer, we should see it as just some sort of hocus pocus that takes the place of prayer, but really we're just trying to get God to heal us. Or a third division, which is that physician needs to take responsibility and realize that if a physician kills someone accidentally, they can't say that was God's will. Right? So that tension as to whether physicians should see themselves as exercising power or simply as channels is very important to remember. And finally, there's a whole discussion which I think has great value to contemporary social issues about medicine, medical crisis. Right, which Halacha actually has a great deal to say about, about how, or at least on the value scale, of how one balances the cost of medicine, right, with public access, and that should, right, and if you look at that section, that will give some insight into that regard, which seems to argue for a right for a moral duty to treat at the right to treat at reasonable cost, but a decision not to enforce that, which might very well play out in particular contemporary issues. Which is basically the system we have in America now. We could argue whether it works or not, right, in which we impose a moral obligation to provide, right, to provide drugs at reasonable cost, but we argue that the cost, that the price of mandating that would be the absence of loss of competition, right, the loss of research, and so we try and find a balance in which we create an economic incentive for research, but we don't mandate, right, but we try and guilt people into donating large sums of expensive drugs to poor countries and things like that. Right, so it may be that that's actually not totally out of confidence with the with the structure of the tour. Being again, of course, if in a situation where moral suasion fails, right, then you might resort to coercion, right, where you would not have wanted to originally. And then there's a lot of room for discussion whether America currently is a society which, on medical cost, moral suasion has failed entirely. Okay. The last two things I want to address are two responses from the great poskim of our era. The first is Rishlomo Zalman Orbach, and the second is Moshe Feinstein, which address what at first glance may seem to be tangential issues, but I want to argue are also central, both on their narrow issues and possibly on making upon a broader claim. Rishlomo Zalman addresses the question of whether it is permitted for an Orthodox Jew, whose life is not in danger, to go to a non-Orthodox doctor's office on Shabbat, knowing that the non-Orthodox doctor will turn on the light and write a prescription. Am I allowed to impose my need to be healed on the doctor at the cost of his soul? Right? Or you can frame it really dramatically, right? You know, do I care that he is killing himself eternally for the sake of healing me in this world? And Shlomo Zalman makes the rather startling claim that he believes that one is entitled to go to the doctor. One does not have to care about the consequences, right, about the consequences to the doctor. I think it's an interesting analogy, right? What happens if somebody owes you money and says, if you take me to court, I'm going to curse God. So do you have to not take them to court because they're going to curse God? No. Right? It's not right. The fact that somebody else is going to sin does not prevent you from living your normal life. Right? On that analogy, the case is not so powerful. What I want to suggest is that implicit in the case, right, is the notion of doctors as servants. Right, the doctor, right, that we see the doctor's obligation to heal as so powerful that one has the right to impose it on them, even though you understand that what you're doing is creating a cost to the doctor which could not possibly be worth it. Right, from your perspective, you're imposing a cost on the doctor that in no way is justified. But because, right, the doctors, by virtue of being doctors, right, are subject to the public need. And I could push his case further in the way of illustrating this. Right? As opposed to thinking about doctors, suppose I have a next door neighbor with me from, and I need a Tylenol. And I know that if I go ask them for Tylenol, they're going to open a package, right, in a way which is a violation of Shabbat. Am I entitled to ask them for a Tylenol, even though I know they'll violate Shabbat? I would think no. Right, I think it's the fact of being a doctor that creates that. I'm not sure if Shlomo Zalman would agree, but I think that the argument he makes here is one that has great intuitive appeal in the specific case and has much less appeal in the case I construct. So that raises a question generally, right, which I think is a very important question in all areas of modern life, about whether the belonging to a specific profession imposes ethical duties that go go beyond or even in conflict with halakha. I know that I was deeply upset with friends of mine who argued at some point that journalistic ethics require disclosure of information which would otherwise be lashon hara. I happen to be a very, very strong supporter of the necessity for an open, vibrant press in halakha community. And I think that one should not use the laws of lashon hara as an excuse for covering up serious crimes that there is a social need to expose. But I also don't think that journalistic ethics means that I need to know all the peccadilloes of particular movie stars who might actually be interested in privacy. I think that's the case where it's clear that halakhic ethics, the journalistic ethics, has no truck with halakhic ethics, and being a journalist requires you to expose seamy details of people's lives to no public utility, then you just can't be a journalist. But I think that there are other areas where it might be that being a member of a particular profession imposes certain obligations on you that to either go beyond or modify halakha in some ways. I just finished reading the late Shaul Yisraeli's argument that being a state imposes certain obligations on you in conflict with halakha in terms of moral behavior in war. That one is bound by the Geneva Convention even if on occasion it might be that halakhically one is required to kill somebody rather than capture them. But if one has they become a state and bound by contemporary moral norms, then you can no longer kill people just because it saves other people's lives. Because your obligations are modified by being part of a particular community. And I think the Reform of Zalman begins to suggest that doctors may be that way. The last, which is a strong development of that, but I don't know if it's like me. And again, I admit up front, I'm going to try and finish much earlier tonight. I admit up front that this is a tendentious and idiosyncratic reading. But having said that up front, I'll offer it to you and you'll see if you go along with it. Rav Moshe is addressing a question from a young doctor, I suspect from his last name, a doctor with a long rabbinic pedigree, who's just finished his training and wants to know how to behave on Shabbat. So Rav Moshe begins with a long excursus about how to behave on Shabbat. And then he says, I wrote all this longer than I ordinarily would, and all this is really just a sort of introduction to the real question you asked, which is, what do I do about Gentiles? What do I do as a doctor about treating Gentile patients in violation of Shabbat? Because the person who asked the question knows perfectly well that the norm of the halakha is that one violates Shabbat to save Jews, but not to save non-Jews. And that the halakha about saving non-Jews suspended, is overridden mishum eva, because of hatred, and what the exact content of that is has been a matter of controversy over the years. So Rav Moshe gives a really extended and fascinating answer. So he begins by saying that, well, the Gemara says you can always get away with it because it's vague, there really shouldn't be hatred, because if anybody asks you, why aren't you willing to treat this person, you would say, well, we keep Shabbos, so we break Shabbat to preserve those who keep it. We don't break Shabbat to preserve those who don't keep it. So displaying a wonderful awareness of reality, Rav Moshe says, well, that wouldn't work today in America. If you tried that today, certainly nobody would say, oh, that's right, you're Shomer Shabbat, let the patient die. In fact, not only would they fire you, they would probably prosecute you. So that's stage one, that you can't just rule mechanically from the Gemara, since the Baye says you can say this, so just say it, and have me tough on that, then it will work. Okay. Then he says that this obligation extends not only if you're in the hospital, but even if you're an established doctor, and one of your regular patients calls you. And furthermore, even if there's an accident near your house and you're the closest doctor, the doctors are obligated to heal all patients on Shabbat in all cases in which, in contemporary society, we would expect that doctor to be on call. And now he tells you, right, that Abaya's excuses are not accepted in our country, and therefore refusing would be a genuine danger. Right? And even though Sosa wonder how the concern for hatred can permit biblical violations, in our countries currently there is great danger from hatred, even in those countries where Jews can freely choose to observe the Torah, as this freedom certainly does not extend to unwillingness to save lives. Okay, so at this point, Rav Asher just says that Mishum Eva, right, concern for hatred, applies in all circumstances nowadays, right? That's a practical ruling, which is very important to understand. Right, then he says, you know what? I understand that I'm ruling against the Chavetz Chaim. That's the right, that ruling against the Mishnah Berurah is not such a light thing. Right, but he says the Chavetz Chaim wrote that doctors, he's astounded that doctors, even the most pious doctors, he's seen them violate the tchum to treat non-Jews on Shabbos. How can this be? And the Chavetz Chaim concludes that these doctors are absolute Shabbat desecrators. Even if there were hatred caused as a result of observance, right? Rav Moshe says he just doesn't understand how the Chavetz Chaim could ever have written such a thing. Does the Chavetz Chaim not understand that there would in fact have been pogroms in Russia if doctors had failed? Right, doctors had failed to treat. That in many communities there was only one doctor for the surrounding area, and the notion there was a Jewish doctor who wouldn't treat, right, got around. There would be immediate pogroms. He's just astounded how the Chavetz Chaim could have written anything of the sort. And he says, obviously the Chavetz Chaim knew this himself, because there's a little footnote at the bottom of the Mishnah Berurah saying, oh, this is only true in India. Right? So obviously the Chavetz Chaim knew that even the publication of the Halakha would be sufficient to cause pogroms, let alone carrying it out in practice. Right? Then he goes on to say, right, so Russia, since there is accordingly a doubt, and even small doubts generate leniencies in life and death matters, and see Chatam Sofu writes that if hatred will lead to danger to life, we can permit biblical labor to prevent it. He also quotes the Divrei Chaim, who after writing that we don't allow Isurim D'Oraisa in order of Mishum Eva, says, but guess what? Our doctors are lenient anyway, and I've understood that this is because of a takana. So Russia says, what's the takana? I understand, right? What would the takana help this, right? And the answer is, he says, it must be. Right? It must be that. And it's a very interesting argument. He says, it must be that the Divrei Chaim himself believed that in the specific area where he lived, doctors could fail to treat, and that would not cause violent hatred. Right? Because there were enough doctors around. But he was aware that in other cities this was not the case. And he did not choose to impose his understanding of the reality on the doctors. And he let, right, since there are grounds for allowing doctors to treat Mishum Eva, right, he did not choose to say that my understanding of what Eva is here has to be imposed on doctors here, but he accepted the custom of the doctors throughout Europe to treat non-Jewish patients, and he suggests that there might even have been a communal decision, right, to allow doctors to treat everywhere, lest doctors get the decision wrong once. Right, it's simply not worth making one mistake and causing the hatred because of your concern for avoiding violating Shabbat in particular cases. And the motion concludes that in our time it seems to me that we should paskin that there's concern for Eva universally, right? That there's universal concern for hatred wherever you are because of publicity. Because of publicity and immediate publicity by newspapers, that there's no such thing as saying there's an area in which people won't cause hatred because it will spread immediately. Okay, here I need to put in a few details. My nephew told me that I had noticed that apparently every share of mine now is autobiographical detail. So the first is not my autobiography, but all of you are probably aware that Yaakov Rosenbaum died in Crown Heights. Because there was a rumor, among other things, there was a rumor that a Hatzalah ambulance had failed to treat the African American child at the scene. This was a canard in that particular case, where in fact the police had ordered the ambulance away out of fear that
that the ambulance, the EMTs would be assaulted, but even the rumor of failure to treat was sufficient to cause a pogrom.